Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a very special this is a very special episode.
Yes, you're having issues with the episode already, Nick. I'm sorry about that.
Because it's very exciting for me. My guest for this episode is someone I've been reading when I was trying to learn how to be a writer and a critic. So this is very
and you special. Learn what not to do. I know, Nick. Thank you. You can tell me now. Where's my car? I'm gone. I'm done with this already.
And that is, of course, Elvis Mitchell. Welcome, Elvis.
A pleasure to be here. I'm a listener, and I couldn't wait to get here. Listening for a while. And so many of the movies that Amy mentioned, she mentioned Santiago Alvarez, and
oh, yeah.
His Now is actually an inspiration for the way we use riot footage in this.
Oh.
Yeah, because that I don't want to say outsider perspective, but that non-U.S. perspective, which is what a lot of African Americans felt like during the riots. I mean, that was sort of key to the way we put that footage together.
That's one question I want to ask. Do you call it like an essay film? How do you think of
it? I've been calling it an essay. It's certainly documentary, but I mean, Laura Partridge, her documentaries are essays too. I mean, think of it as being essay and documentary.
So is that black enough for you? And it's going to be on Netflix in November. Is that
November 11th?
November 11th.
Same day as Wakanda Forever. So
oh, wow.
Millions of people will be avoiding my film to go see Ryan Coogler's movie.
I think it'll be, watch both of them. But I watched it a little early. And as I was just saying now, I was sort of madly taking notes because they're, first of all, movies that I want to catch up with, but also just, it's such a rich and layered history that you put together. And I think it's actually good for Netflix in the sense that I wanted to pause. I was in the screening room when I was there.
You're not supposed to say that.
Oh, I know, the cinema experience. But I mean, just mentioning about essay film, did you have any models for how you wanted to construct it?
Golly, there's so many, I think of the Louis Malle, the Phantom India, some of those films that documentaries that do work as essays that are really sort of personal takes on things. Because there was a question at the beginning, are you going to be in it? I said, I don't know if I need to be in it. Because I wanted to reserve that real estate for people who actually made movies. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, is sort of the through line for everybody who's in front of the camera. For the most part, the people who made movies during that period, Whoopi Goldberg is an exception just because she grew up in those movies and was inspired by those movies. And Zendaya is in it just because I thought it was important to have somebody from the current generation who could still talk about what's missing from movies even as we speak.
Yeah. And I know that was great. I'm always interested, in with each generation, what they're attracted to in a particular past group of films. So what's the genesis for this film? Just, I don't know if it's related, but there's a wonderful part right in the beginning of the voiceover where you talk about your grandmother and kind of her influence on just framing the world and seeing it through a certain lens. I don't know if that's part of it.
Well, that's a great question to ask because in so many ways, this thing has been shaped over the course of my life, but it goes back to really an experience I had at the 1999 Sundance Film Festival, which is the first time I'd ever gone. I never wanted to go, because I never cared about the movies that came out of Sundance. I don't Spitfire Grill. I don't want to see these movies. And so I was there and I was on the jury and I got sort of dragooned into going into this filmmaker's luncheon and the Hughes brothers were there with American Pimp.
Oh, yeah.
Which people were dying to see and then fleeing once they saw it because it's like, this isn't Pimp My Ride. This is about pimps.
Right.
Yeah, that's hence the title. Yeah. But they were there with, in fact, their pimp. Which was kind of thrilling. This guy in this Louis Vuitton leather suit who's 6'4" and take him to meet Redford. This is great.
Photo op.
And yes, I swear to you, I was hoping for that. Because why not stir up some trouble while you're up there? But then I was just talking to the Hughes brothers about Dead Presidents. And they were saying, we're trying to make The Deer Hunter and we aimed low and we missed, is the way they put it. I'd always thought that you would have chosen that Isaac Hayes song, Walk On By, because, and Albert Hughes said, that moment, the jinx moment where you put somebody in the shoulder, he said, because it's stolen from Once Upon a Time in the West. And I remember as a kid reading in something like the Rolling Stone Book of Record Reviews, how that version of the song was grotesque. And I thought, how do you not connect that with Ennio Morricone? I mean, the guitars are even the same tuning as the Morricone Duello Finale, which the first minute and a half of that is inspired by that. And so I got to meet Isaac Hayes later on and I said, you got to tell me. He goes, did you do that on purpose? He said, we were just 8 notes shy of being actionable, is the way he'd put it. And so it was these moments like that made me realize that I wasn't living in a vacuum, that other people of color were seeing these movies the way I was. And there's a kind of experience that you sort of impute to the movies because some movies growing up, we're not in them. Have you seen The Spook Who Sat by the Door? Do you know that? Film?
I saw it a long time ago.
There's a sequence where they start making fun of like slavery movies in it. I mean, you're free, Jasper. Go on out. No, master, I don't know what to do. It's like even then, in the context of this, really I think, wonderful political thriller, and that subverts that. And it's also satire. Yeah. You got this great Herbie Hancock score. Even in the midst of that, there's a meta moment. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of intertextualization that exists as part of being part of outsider culture. And I just thought, maybe I should write this book. And I tried to write the book, and I was at dinner with Toni Morrison, and I was telling her about it. And I guess a lot of people didn't know that she's was a big fan of pop culture. And she goes, well, I'll write the introduction. I just looked around to see who she was talking to, because it couldn't possibly have been me. She goes, no. And we just started talking. She started going on about Pam Grier. And I just said, wait a second. I actually started grabbing napkins and writing these things down, because yeah. She was just talking about, in terms of performance, that people weren't giving her due as an actor, mm-hmm. that wasn't happening, because those films were being regarded as somebody playing out an archetype, right. and playing with archetype. And certainly that was part of it, and maybe not intentional, but that was what was going on. But she said, you can't look at that and not look at her, Pam Grier, in sort of the tradition of black women in storytelling, and what was resting on her shoulders, and what that performance was doing. And it became bigger than just being badass. She hated that word being used for that, because she wanted to go back to the reason Melvin Van Peebles used in the first place, to outrage and shock people to keep the movie's title from being mentioned on television.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, that's a great moment in the film where you mentioned that part of that title is that it could not be mentioned. There's so many threads that the movie takes on the way to describing the revolution in the 70s. And that's part of what I like about it, is that you don't try to locate any one place, that you don't say that it was this movie that started it all. You kind of trace different threads. Something like Night of the Living Dead, a horror movie that is part of independent film history, but then you realize, oh, it's really significant that it's a black lead in that movie and how that plays out. And then the echo of the riots, which is a fascinating observation.
You can't see that footage and not think about, again, Medgar Evers or Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. And it's especially impactful for militants and people who wanted to be part of the revolution, who just sort of thought that was a cautionary tale. That's what you get when you mix the races. I mean, this film being about black self-determination and having to look out for ourselves first. And it's, again, so I'm so glad you asked that question, Nick, because it's, in some way, this fuse was lit for me a long time ago. And it burned and burned and then fizzled out and then finally got made here. But all these things are in that way that I think all of us as people who are critical thinkers about film, when we're watching a movie, we're often asking ourselves the question, what isn't being said here? And what isn't there? And what is inference? And what is implication? And again, I had to go back to intertextualization, but that becomes what it's about when you're part of outsider culture. Why am I not here? And how do I build a road to myself sort of figuratively into this? And then literally just to do that. I mean, I just, again, remember as a kid hearing that Richard Pryor record where he just talks about Logan's Run, that great moment. They don't plan on us being here. Which is this kind of joke that every black person makes when they see it there. It's like, yeah, that's kind of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's just so much that I think in my life that led me to this. Mm. Again, at one point I thought it was going to be a book in the sort of the world of what Mark Harris did with the Pictures of the Revolution. And I have to even say it's way partially inspired by Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, just because a friend was telling me about the book, and I said, well, so I can't wait to read this just so I can see what he says about how these black movies sort of finance. And my friend said, well, there's no black people mentioned in the book. And I went, okay, how is it possible to do this?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's even the book presumably about sort of like bad boy culture and that kind of thing, then how do you not mention these movies?
Yeah.
Again, it's about what's not being said.
What's not being said, yeah. And yeah, for example, talking about that book makes me think of the comment in the film that Sweet Sweetback pioneered selling the story of selling the film, which is basically Sundance in a nutshell.
Oh my God, absolutely. And in the 80s then, there have been two filmmakers who followed up on that. There's Spike Lee in 86 with She's Gotta Have It, and then Robert Townsend in 87 with Hollywood Shuffle, which is the making of the movie, the financing of the movie, because if you don't do that, then it's a black film, which means it's relegated to wherever black films are relegated at the period. Mm-hmm. When Sweetback was made, it's like, well, it's another black film, I guess, by a black person. We wish it well. So there has to be something revolutionary. I mean, the very act of commerce becomes political in terms of the way these movies are positioned.
Yeah, yeah. At some point, I want to just ask you about particular actors that you knew well, but also rediscovered just in working on the film.
Who are you thinking?
Well, again, not like a rediscovery, but like having an appreciation of Ivan Dixon, who we were basically talking about already.
Well, yeah, but again, I heard the episode when you and Amy were talking about Nothing But a Man. And what Romer does is that it's interesting to see a movie like that where there is no explanation offered for why this is about black people. It's just about black people. It is, yeah. And there's no white person who comes in and sort of basically say, justify their presence on screen.
Yeah.
Again, that's kind of a revolutionary act. And also the way he shoots people. I mean, he shoots Ivan Dixon like a movie star. And it's a weird thing to say now, but to have a black film with Motown music, mm-hmm. At a time where Motown albums didn't have black artists on the cover because Berry Gordy didn't want to alienate white people. So for Michael Vollmer to say, no, I'm going to claim this for this, and then Motown went, oh, it's a movie? Okay. Yeah, it's fine. We don't care. That, for me, it's hard to just sort of light on a movie and move on because you could do an entire thing on Nothing But a Man. Ivan Dixon is somebody I kind of grew up seeing, and you see him on Hogan's Heroes. You can see his distaste for being in that show. And but then doing Hogan's Heroes, he meets Michael Kahn, who was the editor on Hogan's Heroes. Yeah, yeah. And I got to meet Ivan Dixon when Spook was re-released, when Tim Reed picked up the rights to do it. And I said, so did you hire Michael Kahn because he was your editor? He goes, yeah. Al Ruddy, who was the producer of Hogan's Heroes, who had these Academy screenings. And Michael Kahn and I were sitting in the back, and I'll just say, I can't stand being on this show. And Mike would say, well, when you quit, when you make your movie, let me know and I'll cut it for you. So he cuts Trouble Man, and then he cuts The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Yeah, and other threads from that. I mean, the Motown comment makes me think of another thing in the movie of just having an In Cooley High, I think, having Motown almost repatriating Motown music, which is interesting because, you know, Scorsese, I love Scorsese, but then it's such a big thing of like, oh, using Motown for as a backdrop for this. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But still, from, and it's also the way music plays a thread. You know, you go from that to the very end in Killer of Sheep and then with Scorsese in Shutter Island.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, I mean, it's just... Yeah. I want to sort of position this movie where like every 5 minutes you kind of go, wait, what?
Yeah.
What? Yeah. What? That was the effect I really wanted it to have.
Yeah, it does that. everything is connected. But there are also these great moments in the movie where you just crystallize a whole period in a new way. And I'm thinking of the idea of heroism and anti-heroes.
Was that interesting to you?
Yeah. Or
no, I'm glad to hear that. But I just wanted to hear you.
No, because when you have a litany of what the new Hollywood directors are in the 70s and then anti-heroes and, you know, Altman, et cetera, all these movies that, you know, we love. But in blaxploitation movies, people were happy to be heroes, period.
Oh, no, I know exactly. That's why I use that Olivier line about heroism, which I always thought was this incredible thing. And I thought, well, it's interesting because when you have the entirety of a pop culture to choose from, you can be selective about being a hero or being an anti-hero. And even, you know, in that period where Robin Hood and Robin and Marian, Robin Hood's an anti-hero and down on his luck and spiritually impotent and comes back from a war that's, again, another stand-in for Vietnam.
Right.
I mean, with Sean Connery goes from being James Bond to a beat down Robin Hood, you think, oh my gosh. And when these black films start coming, and it's not just blaxploitation films, it's Billy Dee Williams in Lady Sings the Blues, who plays somebody who, if you dig into the history, wasn't a particularly reputable character, but plays with this kind of brio that's missing from the movies. And the fact is that these movies made a lot of money. I have some quotes in the film from John Kelly, who I had met in around 2001, and I just said to him, you've got to tell me, because I know you just get this question all the time. How much did you guys pay to make Superfly? And you start laughing. Nobody's ever asked me that question. It's $150,000, which I could probably have done personally. So I could have bought that movie myself. And it was amazing to me because he said, in terms of a return on a dollar, the Superfly was probably the biggest hit that Warner Brothers had during his time running the studio, because then I met Jim Signorelli, who shot it. He goes, yeah, we shot for $75,000. He said, at the end of every night, I would go and buy leftover stock from commercial shoots so we could keep going, so we never had enough film.
Wow. Yeah, no, and that, yeah, that sort of resourcefulness is also incredible. And Superfly, again, you're able to talk about the filmmaking is too. I guess we haven't touched as much on that, but how in that movie it has this very kind of pioneering foot chase and how that is shot. But yeah, I think foot chases, and again, not to harp on how people are always forgetting things, but French Connection is usually what people think of sometimes in the foot chase in the 70s, but Superfly has that incredible one as well.
It's an incredible one that's no stuntman.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the amazing thing about it. I mean, because I remember watching this kid thinking, wow, he runs and he's wearing a suede suit that leaps over a fence and then jumps. You can sort of see his hand shake from the adrenaline rush of the jump when he jumps onto the fire escape and pulls himself up.
Yeah.
And he never wears a suit again for the rest of the movie. So when I met Jimmy, he goes, oh, he trashed that suit. And we only had one of them. And we borrowed it. So we had to go try to explain to the guy what happened to this suit because we couldn't afford to pay for it. He said, but yeah, it was this thing where we just had to steal stuff. And then when he starts to invoke the verite of the measles, and
yeah,
and that being a part of it, the way that that foot chase was shot.
Yeah.
And so then I asked Fincher, David Fincher is one of the producers. I said, did Superfly, that chase scene, have an impact on you in making Seven? He goes, well, not consciously, but it must have, because
I
saw it and I remembered it.
Yeah.
So even that, you sort
it's
of,
in there.
Yeah, yeah. These moments reverberate. And again, when heroism sort of died out in the mainstream, I shouldn't say in the mainstream, because these movies were mainstream hits. They weren't just marginal hits or indie hits. For Superfly to have made $30 million in 1972, that means like about 15 million people saw it, which is a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought of Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, because Callie said to me, you know, probably the dirty secret of the movie business is these black films paid for a lot of these studio successes.
Wow. Yeah. That makes it all the more crazy that you have that, you know, awful comment by, I forget which studio head. I think about Lady Sings the Blues or something.
That's Frankie Blanz, who runs the studio, who just comes out and says, well, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I know. Spoiler alert.
Sure. Yeah. Spoiler alert. That's right. Spoiler. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, but a white studio head shockingly doesn't think Lady Sings the Blues doesn't have much of a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it's crazy. So another great theme in the film, again, that is able to characterize like just sort of all of film history in a wonderful way. I want to get it right, but you say something about movies being trapped in the 60s. They were trapped in trying to shape the culture instead of respond to it. And I thought that was, yeah, another phrase that just kind of lights everything up as well. I mean, could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it's just this thing where the movies didn't seem to realize their power. They felt in this kind of weird way, like afraid. Mm. I almost kind of feel like movies went from the 50s to the 70s.
Mm.
They weren't really the 60s in the movies, because they weren't really being reflected. You have stuff like, you know, the Godard's Rolling Stones doc. And again, another thing that was kind of influential just in terms of essayistic and tonal terms. And so that these movies, the studios are just so afraid of the 60s, you know, they would drag sort of kicking and screaming into it with Bonnie and Clyde, and then it was Bob Rafelson was in tight with Bert Schneider, whose dad ran Columbia, then they wouldn't have got to make those movies there. I mean, it's so at a point where movies could have sort of stepped up and actually had some effect. I was even thinking back to the Mark Harris book when Five came back, when he writes about how even the Department of War, which is what the Department of Defense was called, saying, even we're more progressive than the studios are. You know, even we use black people in a way that you guys don't. This is wrong.
Yeah.
But there's just this kind of, gee, I'm always kind of loath to try to crystallize, because it seems like this sort of schism or this intersection between inertia and institutional racism. But in the end, it's still the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
It casts people out. And what happened in the 70s sort of through sheer inadvertence was, as black actors start to be tapped, as these movies start to be successful, and these hustlers sort of said, well, let's throw black people in them, and the black experience starts to be imparted through these films, then the studios have a chance to say, ah, this is happening, we're making money, what's the next logical step?
Mm-hmm.
And they still don't shape culture at the end, and they still run away from it after years and years of sort of proven track records by these movies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the insane thing. I mean, supposedly speaking their language in terms of box office, you know.
But also speaking their language in political terms.
They're all
liberals. They're all progressives. Right. And they have Harry Belafonte talk about, and to me, that's the spine of the movie.
Yeah.
It's Harry Belafonte. And you asking me about wanting to make it, and I realize I digress myself. But I've always thought of him as being this incredible case of somebody who was a movie star, who rather than take movies that he thought were demeaning, not beneath him, but demeaning to the culture and to his people, he chose not to make a movie for a decade.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Have you ever seen Odds Against Tomorrow?
I love it. Yeah. I
Okay. So you know that this is the movie where everybody in the movie is in love with Harry Belafonte. I mean, the elevator operator is hitting on him in the elevator.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
Right.
And one of my, something that made my jaw drop as a kid, and one of the reasons I wanted to make this is to include the scene where Richard Bright walks up to the bandstand and starts flirting with him.
Yeah.
To me, it's still kind of amazing to go, wait, I remember seeing Godfather and going, that's the guy who hit on Harry Belafonte in Odds Against Tomorrow.
Right.
This is great. And so for that, in that movie, have him basically be sort of the sexual center of the movie with no purchase into the mainstream. He can't, you know, he's leading, what is this, the Modern Jazz Quartet in this CD bar, where, by the way, Cicely Tyson is the bartender without a speaking role.
Oh, wow.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
These and that movie, I just thought, my God. And you just wonder, well, why didn't Harry Belafonte, what happened to him?
Yeah.
I remember seeing some documentary recently, I think PBS or something, about, again, badass black men or something. Somebody goes, yeah, well, you know, those Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier movies, they were nothing. I wouldn't, he didn't make movies, you idiot. Don't, yeah. if you shouldn't be an expert right. in a documentary about film if you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, no, I think you say that Belafonte was like the Muhammad Ali of.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that comparison because it also underlines that the political thing that went into it, you know, it was, and Odds Against Tomorrow, I love, because it's also a movie that shows, I mean, basically everyone loses, you know, that's it was a blacklisted screenwriter, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Polanski, yeah.
Sort of real revelation when I saw it. All the actors that you gather for this film, which is just incredible, you know, lineup. Harry Belafonte very much speaking his mind.
But the great thing about Harry Belafonte, too, is that he falls into that weird tradition of actors like Seth Rogen and
wait, I want to hear this.
Well, no. And Kiefer Sutherland, these actors who have voices that are 20 years older than they are.
Oh, yeah.
So when Kiefer Sutherland, like Seth Rogen's, wait, who's this 40? Oh, that's Seth Rogen. And Kiefer Sutherland, this voice is older than he, too. And Belafonte, when he's in his 30s, sounds like a 50-year-old guy.
Yeah.
So when he's in his 90s, he sounds like a 50-year-old guy. You go, wow. I mean, he's still got the same voice. But you see, you know, Island and the Sun, and you realize that they had the clip of there for a reason, because that suit doesn't fit him. Mm-hmm. And generally in movies of that period, because they're all kind of about making everybody look good, even the extras wore suits that were fitted to them. Yeah. And he made a choice, no, I want to make sure that you realize this is a guy who wears a suit that probably was handed down to him by his father, mm-hmm. that he bought at a thrift store, mm-hmm. and that it's not, he's not supposed to look great in this suit. No. Oh, that's... Yeah, that's interesting. But that means he's thinking about that character in terms of character, and in terms of, you know, about where he came from. And there's a backstory in that outfit.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. And interviewing Harry Belafonte, what was his response to an endeavor like this? That must be pretty interesting as well, to have that dialogue.
Well, I know him a little bit for a long time. Yeah. I worked on this the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award to Sidney Poitier. So he was there, and it's interesting because the difference between he and Poitier was that Sidney's like kind of Sidney, you know, he mm-hmm. wanted to look to you in the eye and young man, tell me about what it is you've been doing today. And that way that almost, that sounds too formal for human beings to speak, and it coming from him, and you just kind of, what did you, I had breakfast. And what did you have for breakfast today, young man? Was it satisfying to you? Was it nourishing to you? And Harry was just kind of impish, and I remember I was wearing this pair of shoes, and he goes, how you doing, sport and life? And I went, well, gee whiz, can you sing for me the way you sang in Carmen Jones? And he just glared at me for a minute. Then he started laughing because he gives people a hard time just because that's who he is. And I just even mentioned it to him then about his sort of disappearance in the movies. He just said, yeah, I just couldn't do those things. And that was interesting too, because being worked in the special, Ivan Dixon showed up, and then Luke Gossett was there. Morgan Freeman came in everywhere. I kind of go, yeah, you know, at one point, we were hoping that Sidney would die so we could get some of those roles. And then we all realized if Sidney died, they just weren't going to make those movies.
Okay.
That sort of informed that. And then I was at the Havana Film Festival, gosh, 20 years ago this year.
Oh, wow.
And Harry was there. And whenever I run into him, he's always incredibly friendly to me, even before I was at the Times, because he would just start making fun of me. But we had, I thought, was a pretty fun relationship. Mm-hmm. And he was in the Havana Film Festival, and that was like being around Jay-Z. I mean, he was surrounded by people, and everybody was passing him CDs that they made and cassettes. And for you kids listening, that used to be the way people listened to music, recorded music. And people were stuffing notes in his pockets, and he was taking time to talk to everybody. And I just mentioned, well, I'm thinking about doing the thing. He goes, well, I'll give you my number again. You've never called me, but I'll give you my number again to do this. And then I did a Q&A with him at Sundance when that documentary on him came out about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he told this this story. I've never seen anything like this before. I said, so it's interesting watching this documentary because I wonder about where the courage comes from for you to go to these places to help get people fed where your life is in danger. And he said, well, Martin Luther King had a stutter. And I just went, oh God, okay. Let's see where this leads. He goes, and you had to know him to hear it, but if you knew him, you could hear it when he spoke. Okay, and I'm going to shorten the story because I can't do it justice. He said, we're at the March on Washington, and he gave the speech, and those of us who knew him realized he didn't stutter anymore. And I just said to him, you didn't stutter. And Dr. King said, yeah, well, I just realized I'm probably not going to live much longer, and I'm probably going to die at somebody's hand. So after that, what's a stutter? and you could hear people sobbing in the audience as he told the story. And I just thought, I got to get this guy on camera to talk about his commitment to his life and how that example taught him you do what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't sell yourself short. He didn't put it in terms of selling out. He said, you don't sell yourself short because as a person of color, if you're selling yourself short, then you're giving your people short shrift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that ending that you have to the essay, you know, about how you one sees oneself and how other people see oneself and the distance and difference between that.
Yeah, well, that comes out of this because we're trying to figure out sort of people saying, well, why isn't Sidney Poitier in this? And I didn't know that there was a Poitier documentary being made, but it was tough because he had an unusual, probably the most unusual stardom of any American actor, where not only was he not in fashion, but he was ridiculed. I mean, he was made fun of for being this. I mean, he went from being the biggest thing in the world to being a relic, to being irrelevant, to being an object of ridicule in less than a year. I can't think of anybody who's had that precipitous a fall in the movies and who didn't give up and who came back and found a way to do that. But it's just about how do you do that? And again, there's nothing wrong with encomia, but how do you tell the story of Sidney Poitier in some way that somebody hasn't really done before? And my experience with him had been, and I when Mark Harris saw the movie, he goes, yeah, I know what you're talking about. You talk to him, like I get him on the phone, or I ran for that anecdote at the end. I ran into him at the LA Film Festival, and his daughter Sidney said, you got to come meet my dad. Well, I've met your dad before, but she's, well, you got to, and young man, how are you? Well, did you see some motion pictures you liked here today? Oh my God, yes, of course. And so we end up standing there talking for, I'm not kidding, an hour and a half. Uh-huh. It's like, if we just drive 2 miles over here, we can record some of all, this. Yeah. And no. But he was so generous about why he couldn't talk to you, which is kind of hilarious to me. But I just was wrestling with this about how do you make that make sense. It's finally that, you know, he recognized, well, I'm not going to do this kind of thing anymore when I try to make a movie for everybody. I'll make a movie for the people who always come up to me, who have always supported me. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it reminds me of Cotton Comes to Harlem, where it's a bunch of people who clearly had never worked together in the way they wanted to. You can feel that sense of pleasure they get, and that's what happens in a lot of these movies too. You can feel the sense of play of actors inspired by other actors who are like them. I mean, Helen Martin, who was in Cotton Comes to Harlem, she goes back to working. She was a part of the Mercury Players, like doing theater with Orson Welles. She's a journey person actor who spent her entire career doing this. So she's in the movie with Cleavon Little. And Red Fox is in the movie for the first time in his career. That leads to Sanford and Son, because Norman Lear and Bud York can see that. And they go, we bought this British show, but we don't know what to do with it. Would you want to play a junk man? And he goes, I just played a junk man in this movie. He goes, well, you want to do it on TV? He goes, yeah, I'll do it. So, I mean, again, these things have so many repercussions, and it was fun to sort of chart that, too.
Yeah. I guess just to sort of bring things in for a landing, I want to know if there are any particular movies that, because I like to kind of give listeners, what can they go watch? You know, were there particular movies that you rediscovered in a new way through doing
this?
Let me
ask you, because you were seeing it, what are the movies that were kind of resonating for you? Because you wrote some titles down.
Yeah, I did. I mean, this is not new at all, but it's like, you know what? I'm just going to watch Killer Sheep again for the 10th time because it's wonderful. But, you know, a movie like that I have not seen, a Cornbread Earl and Me, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it's that, again, because, you know, when it comes to black movies, there's never any history. So when Boys in the Hood came on, nobody ever went, well, you know, that's Cornbread Earl and Me. And it's even got Lawrence Fishburne, who was in it.
Oh, yeah.
20 years earlier. It's like, oh. But who would be the person in 1992 who would have mentioned something like that? unfortunately. But I think there's the movie Sparkle, which Joel Schumacher wrote to direct himself, and he didn't get a chance to direct it. And again, so much of this is about these strands that you're talking about that connect. And with Curtis Mayfield, who wrote, I mean, imagine writing four iconic scores over the course of 10 years, in addition to being part of a 20-album output that you put out, two records a year over the course of 10 years.
Yeah.
And four of them are soundtracks and unforgettable. And this movie, Claudine, which I just interviewed Robert Townsend recently for the 35th anniversary of Hollywood Shuffle. And he got a chance to tell a story in the way that I wasn't able to, which is that the actress Diana Sands, who's in, gosh, so many things, the landlord. And she had developed this movie, Claudine, to star in. And she, like Rupert Cross, unfortunately, came down with cancer before she had a chance to do it. And passed it on to her friend Diane Carroll, who had never been thought of in that way. Interestingly, I mean, because this TV show she did in the late 60s called Julia was thought of being somebody who was going to had this pristine beauty that made her kind of unassailable. And that wasn't who Diane Carroll was. It wasn't the way she grew up. And so she's thrilled to get a chance to do this. But again, there's so many of these films that we're talking about. Yeah. Well, what else for you? Because I'm curious.
I mean, I guess I'm kind of something like Hitman, sort of deeper cuts, I guess.
Yes. But even something like Uptight, which is not a particularly great film, but it's a fascinating movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's because they have the audacity to try to set a heist film during the funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's... You almost want to like give the movie props for just doing something like that. Yeah. It's also the first studio movie with a black woman screenwriter, Ruby Dee. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny because even in his book, when Booker T. writes his autobiography, he dismisses Uptight as being a blaxploitation film. You go, well, no, it wasn't that. I mean, right. It was an attempt to do something else. And there are so many films.
Yeah, no, there are so many. I guess my habit sometimes is looking at the deep cuts, but it was also just seeing things in a new way as well. Well, let me ask the kind of ceremonial last question for the show. You're not...
go ahead. I've been ready for this, but go ahead.
So what was the last film you saw?
I went to see Amsterdam last night.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because I didn't get a chance to see it screen. I wanted to see it in a theater.
Yeah.
And it kind of felt like, wow, it's... You can sort of see what's wrong with it in the first scene, mm-hmm. where it's almost twitchy. It so wants to grab you by the collar and say, listen to this story. This is a great story. Yeah. And everybody in the movie is almost directed to be like that.
Okay.
And I'll ask you this. I want to ask you, what's the last thing you saw? So you're not getting off the hook here.
No,
absolutely.
This is
what I kind of do, yeah. Dick. So now it's my
sure,
turn.
No, it's good. I have to see Amsterdam. I haven't seen it yet. Okay, the last thing I saw would have been Decision to Leave.
Oh, it's... And
it's wonderful. I mean, this is the third time I saw it, so... It has these great twists and turns, but I love it. I really think it's one of the
best. I'm trying not to give anything away, but yeah, it's the kind of thing where you... Before you see it, you wonder if it's going to live up to what you've heard about it.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, they didn't even mention this stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It's just
so much.
It's so dense.
Yeah.
That... See,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
See, yeah, it's good. Doesn't it feel good to get something off your chest?
Yes.
Talk about, maybe you should do a show you talk about movies and talk about movies yourself instead of asking other people. In fact, this is an invitation. Will you come do my show sometime?
Yeah, I would love to, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, I couldn't have thought of a more wonderful way to end the show.
Yeah, you could, but that's sweet of you to say. No. Thank you.
But Elvis, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, and I hope to get to come back and do it again.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.